This episode includes details of extremely gruesome and violent crimes. Listener discretion is strongly advised. On the evening of July 22, 1991, Tracy Edwards and two of his friends were hanging out and drinking beer in downtown Milwaukee. They were approached by a tall man with sandy blonde hair and a mustache. He engaged the three men in conversation and introduced himself as Jeff. Before long, Jeff suggested that they go back to his place to drink some more. The man convinced Tracy that they would go get the beer while Tracy's two friends would catch up with them later. He gave the men an address where he said they could meet them. Jeff and Tracy bought some beer, got into a taxi, and took a short trip to the Oxford Apartments on North 25th in Milwaukee. Jeff led Tracy to an apartment on the second floor. The first thing Tracy noticed about the apartment was the smell. It had what he called a foul odor, which he could not place at the time. Jeff calmly explained that a pipe had burst and the apartment owner had yet to fix it. After drinking some beer, Jeff gave Tracy a rum and coke. Tracy sipped it and watched some Siamese fighting fish that Jeff had kept in an aquarium next to his couch. Suddenly, he felt something on his wrist. He turned and found a pair of handcuffs on one of his arms. He moved quickly enough that Jeff was not able to get the cuffs on the other wrist, but Tracy was now very alarmed. Something strange was happening in this apartment, and it was about to get much stranger. Jeff then produced a large knife and held it up against Tracy's chest. He told Tracy that if he did as he was told, he would not be hurt. Jeff told Tracy that he wanted to see him naked. Tracy nervously began to unbutton his shirt. Then Jeff guided him into a bedroom where Tracy noticed a huge blue barrel and an even more foul stench. A horror movie was playing on the television. Jeff told Tracy to sit on the bed and then he sat beside him. Side by side, they watched the movie while Jeff occasionally chanted and rocked back and forth. Tracy did his best to keep Jeff calm as he tried to come up with a way to escape the horrible apartment. Jeff then told him to lie face down on the floor. Tracy partly complied but stayed on his side so he could keep one eye on his host. Jeff put the knife to Tracy's chest again.
He told me to lay down face down, put both of my hands behind my back because he changed again at that point, like he got more aggressive at that time.
Okay, now but tell us, did he still have the knife out?
Yes, he still had the knife.
And what did you do?
Okay, I kind of like laid on my sides for some reason. I guess God told me not to lay flat down or let this person handcuff me, so I didn't.
So you were trying to stop that from happening, but you got down on the floor.
Right.
What did he do?
He kind of laid across me, put his head across my chest at that point.
What was he trying to do?
Like he was listening to my heart, because at a point he told me he was going to eat my heart.
Said he was going to eat your heart?
Yes, that's correct.
Then, when Jeff turned his attention to something else in the room for a moment, Tracy took his chance. He punched Jeff once in the face and then kicked him in the stomach. Jeff was stunned just long enough to give Tracy time to bolt for the door. He scrambled out of the apartment, down the stairs, and into the street. At 11:25 p.m., Tracy came across a police squad car with two officers inside. With the handcuffs still dangling from his left wrist, he dashed toward the car, frantically trying to get the officers' attention. Quickly and breathlessly, he relayed to the officers what he had just endured. They decided to accompany him back to the apartment. When they arrived, they were greeted by Jeff, who appeared unconcerned. They asked several questions, which Jeff answered calmly. Eventually, one of the officers asked Jeff where he could find the key so he could uncuff Tracy. Jeff pointed towards the bedroom. The officer headed that way. Shortly after he disappeared into the room, he yelled out to his partner, "Cuff him." What happened next would change the world.
I heard a knock on the door, and the police were there with the last victim. They asked me where the key was to the handcuffs. My mind was in a haze. I sort of pointed to the bedroom, and that's where they found the pictures. And they yelled, "Cuff him."
Welcome to the Crimes in History podcast, where we remember the true crimes that changed the world. Please note that our episodes often deal with extreme violence and may not be suitable for all listeners. See the show notes for the sources that we use to create this episode and follow us on Twitter at Crimes History. Jeffrey Lionel Dahmer was born in 1960. His father, Lionel, was a student at Marquette University in Milwaukee at the time. Jeff's mother, Joyce, stayed home to care for the young boy. According to his father, Jeff was a normal young boy growing up, except that he was extremely shy. The young family began in Wisconsin, spent some time in Iowa as Lionel finished his PhD program, and then finally settled in Ohio, where Lionel found work as a research chemist. Jeffrey was just turning 8 years old when the family moved into a house in the city of Bath, not far from Cleveland. The young boy did not have an easy adjustment to his new home. He was painfully shy and had difficulty making new friends. Making it even harder was the fact that the family moved to Bath during the summer after school was out, so Jeffrey spent most of his time alone. When he did begin attending school in Bath, Jeffrey was seen as slightly different by his classmates. He was quiet and awkward. At times he would seek attention by doing pratfalls or other types of physical humor, but he found it nearly impossible to truly connect with other kids. Adults in the area, however, found Jeffrey to be a nice boy who just liked to be alone. As he grew older, Jeffrey's parents' marriage began to fall apart. Many nights in the home would devolve into loud and sometimes even violent arguments. To escape the fighting, Jeff would go out into the woods behind the house by himself.
It was unnerving, depressing, made me angry sometimes. I'd leave the house, go out in the woods and sulk, brooding, you know, wondering why they had to have such a rough relationship.
Jeffrey spent a lot of time in the woods by himself. Initially, he spent this time doing innocuous things such as hitting trees with sticks. But over time, his solitary activities took on a more sinister form. Lionel remembered a time when Jeffrey came across the bones of a small animal. The young boy seemed mesmerized by the discovery. According to his father, Jeffrey played fiddlesticks with the bones and examined them for quite some time. Unbeknownst to his family, this interest in dead animals grew into a fascination. Jeffrey would later collect roadkill from nearby roads and bring it back to the woods behind his house. There, he would dissect the dead animals and inspect the insides. Over time, his inspections developed into bizarre experiments. He began using acid to remove the flesh from animal carcasses and sometimes decapitated them. Jeffrey kept this macabre habit a secret from everyone until years later. In fact, there were many things going on in Jeffrey's mind and in his life that he kept hidden deep inside.
From about 15 years on up, a great deal of my thoughts were basically unshareable.
Years later, Lionel would look back on Jeffrey's childhood and reflect on some other events that stood out as somewhat odd.
When he was 4 and pointed to his belly button, and asked what would happen if someone cut it out. Was that merely an ordinary question from a child who had begun to explore his own body? Or was it a sign of something morbid already growing in his mind? When we went fishing and he seemed captivated by the gutted fish, staring intently at the brightly colored entrails, was that a child's natural curiosity, or was it a harbinger of the horror that was later to be found?
Always a bit of a loner, Jeffrey withdrew even further into his own thoughts as he reached his teenage years. He also discovered alcohol around the same time. By the time he was 14, he was drinking heavily. At times, he would even drink during class. One time he was caught by a teacher drinking on school grounds. However, he was able to convince the teacher that he did not have a drinking problem. Among the other students, though, it was well known that Jeffrey was an alcoholic. The drinking may have been Jeffrey's attempt to drown out the dark thoughts that were beginning to consume him.
I think it was around age 14 or 15. Started having obsessive thoughts of violence intermingled with sex. And it just got worse and worse. I didn't know how to tell anyone about it, so I didn't.
Jeffrey's reputation as a shy prankster continued into high school. One time, he drew chalk outlines in the shape of bodies in various places around the school. This morbid act was apparently largely overlooked by his fellow classmates as just another prank. Another time, Jeffrey, who was an average student at best, photobombed the yearbook photo of the National Honor Society group. When the yearbook was published, Jeffrey's face was covered with a black dot. At home, Jeffrey's family life continued to disintegrate. His parents' fighting continued to get worse. By his senior year of high school, they were in the midst of a bitter divorce battle. During the proceedings, his parents fought over custody of his younger brother, David, while Jeffrey was largely kept to the sidelines. In the summer after his high school graduation, the divorce was finalized. His mother moved out, and Lionel lived temporarily in a nearby hotel. For several months, 18-year-old Jeffrey Dahmer was left all alone. On June 18, 1978, 19-year-old Stephen Hicks spent the day with friends attending a concert and enjoying the summer sun. After the concert, he broke off from his friends so he could go give his father a birthday present. He promised his friends he would catch up with them later that night. Since he did not have a car, Stephen got around by hitchhiking, which is how he planned on getting to his father. It was hot that day in northern Ohio, so Stephen stood on the side of the road without a shirt on, holding out his thumb as cars passed by. Eventually, one of them stopped. It was a big Oldsmobile Cutlass. Inside was a young man with blonde hair and a bright smile who introduced himself as Jeff. He asked Stephen where he was heading, and then invited him to go back to his place to drink some beer and listen to music before continuing his journey. The pleasant young man behind the wheel was Jeffrey Dahmer. Jeff drove the pair back to his house, where he was staying by himself at the time, while the details of his parents' divorce were settled. They relaxed in the den, drinking beer and getting to know each other. They were about the same age, both having just graduated from high school. They sat and drank and relaxed as music blared from a nearby stereo. Jeffrey, who had such a difficult time making friends, was greatly enjoying this time with a new companion. He was drawn to Stephen's warm smile, engaging personality, and, most of all, to his bare chest. Things were going great until Stephen mentioned that it was getting late and he had to continue on his mission of taking a gift to his father and then rejoining his friends. That's when a change came over Jeffrey's face. Jeffrey did not want his new friend to leave. As Stephen walked toward the door, Jeffrey picked up a dumbbell and smashed it over the back of his head, knocking him to the ground. Then he pushed the bar of the dumbbell against Stephen's throat and kept pushing until the young man stopped breathing. Jeffrey Dahmer had just committed his first murder.
I wish I just kept on going, but I didn't. Turned around, picked him up, and the nightmare became a reality. We talked, had some drinks. I knocked him out, and that was the first time.
If someone commits a murder in a fit of rage or passion, the natural reaction is to be horrified, disbelieving of what had just occurred. Jeffrey's reaction to killing Stephen Hicks was not one of horror or disbelief. Instead, he laid next to the young man's corpse and masturbated. His only fear was that his father could arrive at the house unannounced, and so, after spending some time with the body, he got to work disposing of it. For that task, he used his experience with dead animals in the woods as a guide. Jeffrey dismembered the body with a knife, put the remains into several garbage bags, and threw them into the crawl space under the house. It was hot and humid in Wisconsin that June, and within a few days, the remains began to emit an awful smell. So Jeffrey retrieved them and buried them in a shallow grave in the woods. That also turned out to be a temporary resting place, as he began to fear that someone would find the hastily dug grave. Digging up the remains again, he removed the flesh from the bones using acid, just as he had with animal carcasses as a child. The horrible liquid that resulted was flushed down the toilet. He then smashed the bones with a sledgehammer and spread them around in the woods. Nobody would have any idea that Stephen Hicks was killed by Jeffrey Dahmer until 13 years later, when Dahmer himself admitted to the crime. Unfortunately, this would be just the first of many murders committed by Jeffrey Dahmer.
Once it happened the first time, it just seemed like it had control of my life from there on end. It was a major part of my thinking from then on.
In the fall of 1978, Jeffrey Dahmer enrolled at the Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio. In one semester there, he would spend a great deal more time drinking than studying. He failed all but one of his classes, dropped out, and retreated to his father's home. Lionel demanded that he either get a job or join the military. He chose to sign up for a 3-year enlistment in the Army. Just after Christmas, Jeffrey went off to boot camp. After boot camp, Jeffrey went into training to become a combat medic, where he learned a great deal about the human anatomy. After medic training, he was stationed in Baumholder, West Germany. There, he quickly fell into his normal routine of drinking heavily and spending most of his time alone. His drinking became so problematic that he was eventually discharged almost a year before his contract was set to end. While there is no evidence that Jeffrey murdered anyone during his time in Europe, there were some disturbing allegations against him. Several different men from that time later accused Dahmer of rape. One of the men even reported the alleged rape to a superior officer, but nothing came of it. Jeffrey was never tried or punished for rape while in the Army. After his discharge, Jeffrey spent some time in Florida, where he again found places to drink and waste time. Before long, he was broke and homeless, so he limped back home to Ohio to live with his father and stepmother. His habits did not change there, though, and Lionel eventually reached the end of his patience. Hoping that a change of scenery might help Jeffrey, he was sent to live with his grandmother in West Allis, Wisconsin. His first months in Wisconsin went well. Jeffrey drank less and helped his grandmother around the house and in the garden. He was even able to use his Army experience to secure a job as a phlebotomist. It didn't take long, however, before he fell into his old habit of drinking to excess. He left beer cans and liquor bottles strewn about his grandmother's house. He lost his phlebotomist job after just 10 months. West Allis was close to Milwaukee, and Jeffrey enjoyed the city life. While he was still shy and a loner, he longed for companionship. He was also struggling with his own sexuality. He began to spend a lot of time at Milwaukee's gay bars and bathhouses.
I go to the nightclubs, drink, watch the striptease shows. And if I didn't meet anyone at the bars, I'd go to the bath clubs and meet someone there.
In 1985, Jeffrey began working at the Ambrosia Chocolate Factory in downtown Milwaukee. He made $8.25 an hour as a laborer on the midnight shift. This was the first job that he would hold for any significant amount of time. He continued to struggle with his sexuality during this time, believing he could have a meaningful relationship with women while continually having sexual encounters with men. He later admitted that the thing he disliked about having sex was that his partners moved around too much. In 1986, Jeffrey found himself in trouble at one of the bathhouses that he had begun to frequent. He had been drugging his fellow patrons, asking them to have a drink, which he had spiked with sleeping pills. Rumors of this practice had been circling around the bathhouses for some time, and eventually the management of Club Bath Milwaukee kicked Jeffrey out of the club for good. Later that same year, Jeffrey got into even more trouble. Two 12-year-old boys reported him to the police, saying he had pulled down his shorts and began masturbating in front of them. Jeffrey maintained that he was simply urinating and had not realized the boys were nearby, but he was convicted of disorderly conduct and given a suspended 1-year jail sentence. This put him on probation, meaning that he had to report monthly to a probation officer. The macabre thoughts that Jeffrey had begun having at age 14 had not dissipated by his mid-20s when he lived with his grandmother. In fact, they were continuing to overpower him. At one point, he made the decision to dig up a recently deceased young man in order to have his way with the body. but he found it too difficult a task to complete. His obsessions would lead him back down the path to murder, 9 years after he killed Stephen Hicks.
It just wasn't an opportunity to fully express what I wanted to do. There was just not the physical opportunity to do it then.
On September 15, 1987, Jeffrey Dahmer claimed his second victim. Stephen Twomey was a recent transplant to Milwaukee who found it difficult to make ends meet in his new hometown. Jeffrey met Stephen at a bar in Milwaukee and invited him back to a room he was renting in the Ambassador Hotel. Jeffrey planned on drugging the 24-year-old Twomey and raping him. He began his mission by putting sleeping pills in Stephen's drink, but then passed out himself before he could complete his ultimate goal. When he woke up, he found Stephen Twomey was dead.
I had put some sleeping pills in his drink to render him conscious. And was just going to spend the night with him. When I woke up in the morning, my forearms were bruised, and his chest was bruised, and blood was coming out of his mouth. He was hanging over the side of the bed, and I have no memory of beating him to death, but I must have. And that's when it all started again.
Just as he had after murdering Stephen Hicks, Jeffrey spent time with the body before going to work disposing of it. This time, there was another factor for him to consider, since he had to find a way to transport the body from the hotel in Milwaukee back to his grandmother's house in West Allis. He left Stephen Twomey's lifeless body in the hotel room while he went out and bought a large suitcase. His plan was to dismember the body in order to make it fit inside the suitcase, but in a gruesome bit of luck, he found that it fit just fine with no dismemberment required. With Stephen's body in the suitcase, Jeffrey hailed a cab and took it back to his grandmother's house, where he could complete the disposal. He had learned from his sloppy first effort in disposing of Stephen Hicks' remains. This time, he immediately used acid to strip the flesh from the bones. He flushed the resulting liquid down the toilet. Not all of the body was discarded, however. Jeffrey decided that he wanted to keep a part of Stephen Twomey with him, forever. He kept the severed head in his bedroom in West Allis. For a while, he kept the hideous trophy in a blanket, but it soon began to decompose. He tried bleaching it and putting it in the oven to clean it, but the skull became brittle and fell apart. Reluctantly, he was forced to destroy and discard it. Keeping the body parts of his victims would become a habit of Jeffrey Dahmer. While he lived with his grandmother, he had to keep the body parts hidden so she wouldn't see them. He was keeping the head and genitals of one of his victims in a box in his room. On a visit to see Jeffrey, his father saw the box and, believing that it contained pornography, demanded to see what was in it.
It was about a 1 foot square box, metal and wood box. My dad, 1 week came to visit and happened to see it and wondering what was in it. He didn't know, nobody knew. And I said, "Jeff, open it up. I just want to see what's in there." We got into a bit of an argument because I wouldn't open it up. And I said, "Jeff, open it up or I'm going to just take it down into the basement and get a screwdriver or something and open it up. I think I've got to stop this from happening." He got angry, very visibly agitated. I thought, you know, it's all going to come crashing down now. Not fathoming what could be in that box, I said, "Okay, just open it up tomorrow then, and then let's get rid of it, whatever it is." The mummified head and genitals of a young man I met in one of the bars down in Milwaukee. But the box was never opened, not in my dad's presence. And so the lies continued.
Jeffrey was able to talk his way out of the predicament, which ultimately led to the deaths of many more young men. The next victim was only 14 years old. Jamie Doxtator had seen a lot in his 14 years. In January 1988, Jamie was lured back to Jeffrey's grandmother's house, where he was killed and dismembered. 21-year-old Richard Guerrero left his parents' home in Milwaukee on March 24, 1988, and never returned. He met Jeffrey Dahmer at a bar. Jeffrey offered him money to go back to his place and pose for nude pictures. Richard, who was almost completely broke, readily agreed. That decision would cost him his life. By this time, Jeffrey's grandmother was becoming tired of all the visitors to her home and the commotion that she heard in her basement. Most of all, she grew tired of the awful smells coming from the basement and the garage. In September 1988, she requested that Jeffrey leave her house. On the 25th, he did just that, moving into a one-bedroom unit in the Oxford Apartments on North 25th Street. He took with him the body parts of several young men. The day after moving in, Jeffrey lured a 13-year-old boy to his apartment, where he fondled him. He undoubtedly had much more sinister plans in mind, but somehow the boy was able to escape the apartment and alert police. Jeffrey was charged with sexual assault and imprisoned briefly before being released on bail. While he was out on bail, he murdered Anthony Sears. Jeffrey met Anthony at a bar. As usual, he persuaded the young man to go to his house. For some reason, he took Anthony to his grandmother's house rather than to his new apartment. However, the result was the same. After having sex, Jeffrey drugged and strangled Anthony and then conducted his usual dismemberment and disposal routine. He kept Anthony's skull and painted it gray, eventually taking it with him to his apartment. In May 1989, Jeffrey was found guilty of second-degree sexual assault and enticing a child for immoral purposes for his attack on the 13-year-old boy and was sentenced to 1 year of prison on a work release program. This sentence allowed him to keep his job at the Ambrosia Chocolate Factory on the night shift. Knowing that police were watching his apartment, he even kept some of his gruesome trophies in his locker at the factory for a time. He was released 2 months early after sending a letter to the judge claiming that he was a changed man. Once he was released from prison, Jeffrey immediately resumed his murderous ways, and his dark, grotesque habits grew worse. His need to control his victims had completely overtaken him. He began to search for ways to make his victims completely subservient without having to go through the inconvenience of killing them.
No, the killing was just a means to an end. That was the least satisfactory part. I didn't enjoy doing that. That's why I tried to create living zombies with uric acid in the drill. No, the killing wasn't the objective. I just wanted to have the person under my complete control to do with as I wanted.
In several cases, Jeffrey poured acid or boiling water into the brains of living victims, trying to turn them into living zombies. The hideous experiment never worked, as his victims always ended up dead. But Jeffrey would turn to another method to keep his victims, cannibalism. Instead of dissolving all of the flesh in acid and then dumping it down the toilet, he began keeping some of it for later consumption. He was especially fond of flesh from the arms and legs of his victims. To Jeffrey, consuming flesh from the young men made them a permanent part of him. It was clear that Jeffrey Dahmer was completely spinning out of control. In addition to murder, dismemberment, cannibalism, and attempting to create living zombies, he was also engaging in necrophilia with some of his victims. And the number of young men who entered Jeffrey's apartment and never left was growing.
There was a big element of wanting complete control over someone, total control, not having to consider their wishes, being able to keep them there as long as I wanted, and that was a big part of it. Lust played a big part of it, controlling lust.
Eddie Smith was Jeffrey Dahmer's sixth victim. On June 14, 1990, he went out for the night. He planned to make it an early night as he wanted to march in the gay pride parade the following day. But when he ran into Jeffrey Dahmer in a bar, that plan changed. Eddie was murdered and his remains were never found. Later, Eddie's sister Caroline said that shortly after her brother's disappearance, she had received a telephone call from a man who claimed that he had killed him. The man on the other end of the line was Jeffrey Dahmer. In July 1990, Ricky Beeks, whose real name was Raymond Smith, told a family member that he was going to visit his daughter in Illinois. When he fell into the path of Jeffrey Dahmer, Jeffrey used his usual tactic. He offered Ricky money to pose for some photographs. When they arrived at Jeffrey's apartment, he drugged Ricky, strangled him, and then performed oral sex on the body. He painted the skull and kept it as a trophy. Over the next year, Jeffrey Dahmer would kill at a dizzying pace. 10 more young men would die in that time, but his murderous rampage was very nearly cut short. On May 6, 1991, 14-year-old Conorak Synthesymphone fell into Jeffrey's clutches. Conorak was able to slip out of the apartment and down to the street. Bleeding and disoriented from the sleeping pills that Jeffrey had given him, Conorak got the attention of two nearby women who called 911.
Okay, hi, I'm on 25th Estate, and this is young man. He is butt naked, he has been beaten up, he is very bruised up, he can't stand, he's study fall out, he is butt naked, he has no clothes on, he was really hurt, and I ain't got no court on him, I just think him, and he needs some help.
Where is he at?
25th Estate, the corner of 25th Estate.
Jeffrey soon found him in the company of the two women and police officers. He told the officers that Conorak was his boyfriend and that he was just drunk. He said the two had been in an argument. The officers, not wanting to get involved in a domestic dispute between two gay men, led Conorak back to Jeffrey's apartment and left the scene. As soon as the officers left the apartment, Jeffrey injected acid into Conorak's brain with the intention of turning the boy into a living zombie with whom he could do as he pleased. Instead, the injection killed Conorak, and his skull became another grotesque monument on Jeffrey Dahmer's mantle.
I saw him sitting on the sidewalk. Two girls were with him. They called the police, and they had to think of this very quickly. They told him he was a friend who gets drunk. He was not wanting to go back, so one officer grabbed him by this arm, another officer grabbed him by the other arm, and they walked him up to the apartment. Mm-hmm. And they left.
Right away? How long did it take from the guy?
That was
later, a relative of one of the girls who had called 911 contacted the police. She was concerned about Conorak and wanted to know if anything had been done to ensure his safety. The officers told her that it was nothing but a domestic dispute, and they had returned the boy, who they believed to be 19, to his boyfriend. The woman was not convinced. If the officers had taken the women more seriously, or had they bothered to look around Jeffrey's apartment, the serial killer's reign of terror would have ended there. Instead, 5 more young men died, including Conorak Synthesymphone. Jeffrey Dahmer's prolific murder career finally came to an end on July 22, 1991. That night, he convinced Tracy Edwards to go to his place, just as he had so many young men before. Tracy had an uneasy feeling as soon as he stepped into the apartment. There was the awful stench, the strange pictures on the walls, and the seemingly out-of-place bottles of acid on the floor. Still, Jeffrey had promised him money to pose for pictures, so he stayed. Tracy's unease became outright fear once Jeffrey tried to cuff him. He managed to keep one arm out of the cuffs and then went into survival mode. He tried to make Jeffrey calm, to make him feel like he was his friend, until he could find a way out. Things began looking even more ominous when Jeffrey pulled out a knife and held it to Tracy's chest, while telling him that he was going to eat his heart. When he was told to undress, Tracy moved to obey, but then Jeffrey told him to sit on the bed. They sat there, awkwardly watching The Exorcist 3. Tracy said that Jeffrey would occasionally rock back and forth and chant while he watched the movie. He had a blank look in his eyes. Then Jeffrey ordered him to lie face down on the floor. Tracy wanted to keep the man in his sights, so he only laid on his side. Jeffrey laid next to him and listened to his heartbeat. Tracy knew it was time to act, or he could very well die in that apartment. He punched Jeffrey and bolted for the door. While he struggled to unlock the door, he feared that a knife would be plunged into his back. Mercifully, he was able to escape. At 11:25 p.m., Tracy came across a police squad car with two officers inside. With the handcuffs still dangling from his left wrist, he dashed toward the car, frantically trying to get the officers' attention. Quickly and breathlessly, he relayed to the officers what he had just endured. They decided to accompany him back to the apartment. Jeffrey was pleasant and calm when the two officers knocked on his door. He invited them in and answered their questions without a hint of fear. Inside, however, Jeffrey was terrified that he was about to be caught. He was also very drunk. When one of the officers asked him where the handcuff key was, Jeffrey pointed towards the bedroom. Inside the bedroom, the officer found a massive blue barrel that was emanating an awful smell. He saw a dark red stain on the wall by one side of the bed, and he found hundreds of Polaroid pictures in a closet drawer. At first, he thought they were part of some sick joke, but he quickly realized they were very real. The pictures showed a number of Jeffrey Dahmer's victims in various stages of death and dismemberment. Some of them showed men with their chest cavities split wide open. In others, the victims were staged in unhuman poses. The officer was horrified. He yelled out for his partner to cuff the blonde man in the living room. Jeffrey heard the cry and knew his time was up. He tried to get out of the door, but the officers quickly overpowered him and pinned him to the ground. As they cuffed him, Jeffrey said, "I should be dead for what I've done."
If you were out on the street now, would you still be committing the crimes?
Probably. If this hadn't happened, there's no doubt I probably would be. I can't think of anything that would have stopped me.
Apartment 213 in the Oxford Apartments was declared a crime scene. Officers would arrive to search the room for other evidence. They found plenty. In the living room, they found an assortment of tools which Jeffrey had used to dismember his victims, including various types of saws. In the kitchen, they found pots and pans and utensils where Jeffrey had cooked and eaten body parts of his victims. The big blue barrel in the bedroom contained the dissolving torsos of three young men. In addition, investigators found two full skeletons, four severed heads, seven skulls, two severed hands, two severed penises, and several bags filled with human flesh and organs. The tray underneath Jeffrey's fridge was filled with blood. The shy young man who had experimented with dead animals in the woods had graduated to keeping a bizarre shrine of human remains in his apartment. Jeffrey would later take full responsibility for his actions.
I feel it's wrong for people who commit crimes to try to shift the blame onto somebody else, onto their parents or onto their upbringing or living circumstances. I think that's just a cop-out. I take full responsibility.
How do you feel about what you did?
I'm glad that it's over. There's nothing, any words I say to the victims' families are just going to seem trite and empty.
Once he was arrested, Jeffrey immediately confessed to his crimes. He refused the services of an attorney, saying that he wanted to get everything out and put an end to the horrors that he had created. He even told investigators about the murder of Stephen Hicks, which to that point they had not linked to him at all. Jeffrey was interrogated for over 60 hours. During the interviews, he spoke in tremendous detail about his method of finding a victim, the way he killed 17 young men, and how he would dismember them. The only victim about whose death he did not give details was Stephen Twomey, as he had been blacked out at the time and did not remember how he killed him. One of the most disturbing details to come out of Jeffrey's confession was his description of the altar he was planning on creating. He said the severed heads and full skeletons that were found in his apartment were intended to be part of this altar. The altar would have a skeleton on each side, with five skulls adorning the center. He said it would be a place where he could meditate and from which he could draw power. While Jeffrey admitted to the murders, as his trial began in Wisconsin, he pled guilty but insane, claiming that he could not know the difference between right and wrong when he was in the grips of his obsession to kill. A number of psychiatrists analyzed him to determine whether or not he was insane. A psychiatrist testifying for the defense diagnosed Jeffrey with borderline personality disorder, schizotypal personality disorder, necrophilia, and a psychotic disorder. The defense said that it was Jeffrey's necrophilia that drove him to kill. The prosecution denied this claim. They said that Jeffrey's attempts to create living zombies with whom he could have sex proved that he was not a necrophiliac. He preferred his victims to be alive but compliant, they said. A psychiatrist for the prosecution agreed that Jeffrey had schizotypal personality disorder, but did not believe that he was insane. He said that Jeffrey knew his acts were wrong, and the fact that he used alcohol as a way of dulling his conscience before committing a murder was proof of it. The two-week trial culminated in closing statements which were given on Valentine's Day, 1992. The defense attorney, Gerald Boyle, claimed that Jeffrey Dahmer was an insane young man who had no control over his homicidal habits. Prosecutor Michael McCann said that Dahmer was not insane, and that he killed young men, quote, merely to afford him a period of sexual pleasure. The jury decided by a vote of 10-2 that the prosecution was right. Jeffrey Dahmer was not insane at the time he committed the murders. Before he was sentenced, some of his victims' family members were given a chance to share their feelings.
You took my mother's oldest grandchild from her, and for that I can never forgive you. I hope you can deal with what you've done. Jeffrey, I hate you!
Jeffrey was sentenced to multiple terms of life in prison without the possibility of parole. Later, he was extradited to Ohio to stand trial for the murder of Stephen Hicks, his first victim, in 1978. He pled guilty to the charge and was given an additional life sentence. Jeffrey Dahmer was imprisoned in the Columbia Correctional Institution in Portage, Wisconsin. In a later interview from prison, he admitted that he still had the compulsion to kill.
No, it never completely goes away. I'll probably have to live with it for the rest of my life. I wish it would go away. I wish there was some way to completely get rid of the compulsive thoughts, the feelings. It's not nearly so bad now that there's no avenues to actually act on it. But no, it never seems to go completely away.
In November 1994, Christopher Scarver was serving life in prison for murder in the Columbia Correctional Institution in Wisconsin. In 1990, he had walked into the offices of the Wisconsin Conservation Corps, where he had previously been a trainee. He was angry that a full-time position that had been promised to him had never materialized. Scarver found Supervisor Steve Lohman in the office and demanded money from him. Lohman handed over $15 from his wallet. Scarver shot him in the head. Jesse Anderson was also an inmate in Columbia in November 1994. One night in April 1992, Anderson and his wife had dinner at a TGI Fridays restaurant in Milwaukee. Afterwards, Anderson said they were attacked by two black men. He was stabbed 4 times in the chest but survived. His wife was stabbed 5 times in the face and head and died. It turned out that there had never been an attack by two black men. Anderson had staged the attack and killed his wife himself. On November 28, 1994, Anderson, who was white, and Scarver, who was black, were assigned to a cleaning detail in the prison along with Jeffrey Dahmer, the notorious serial killer. A guard led the three to a gym which they were assigned to clean and then left the area. Scarver approached Jeffrey and pulled from his pocket a newspaper article detailing Dahmer's crimes. He asked Jeffrey if what was reported in the article was true. He then produced a 20-inch metal bar and beat Dahmer over the head repeatedly with it until the Milwaukee cannibal was dead. Moments later, he found Anderson in another part of the gym and also beat him to death. Scarver nonchalantly told prison officials that he had just murdered 2 other inmates. He said he had been deeply disturbed by Jeffrey Dahmer's actions. He also claimed that Dahmer had taunted other inmates by placing food in the shape of body parts in various parts of the prison. It was long rumored that Dahmer's murders had been motivated at least in part by racism. Most of his victims had been black, and he reportedly told another inmate at one point that he wanted to kill 1,000 black men. For that reason, as well as because of his notoriety, he was almost always accompanied by a guard when he was outside of his cell. There has been speculation that prison officials deliberately gave Scarver unsupervised access to Dahmer, knowing that he would kill the man. Officials have denied this claim. Jeffrey Dahmer's body was cremated and given to his parents. Shortly after his death, his mother Joyce said, "Now that he's bludgeoned to death, is that good enough for everyone?" Lionel, Jeffrey's father, has continued to profess his love for his son in the years following his death. He has written a book about the experience of raising a serial killer, in which he questions whether some of his own actions may have contributed to Jeffrey's demons. Jeffrey's mother, Joyce, passed away in 2000. His younger brother, David, changed his last name to avoid unwanted attention. The apartment building where most of Jeffrey Dahmer's murders took place was demolished in 1992. These are the 17 young men who died at the hands of Jeffrey Dahmer. Stephen Hicks, aged 18. Stephen Twomey, 26. Jamie Doxtator, 14. Richard Guerrero, 25. Anthony Sears, 24. Eddie Smith, 36. Ricky Beeks, 27. Ernest Miller, 22. David Thomas, 23. Curtis Strotter, 16. Errol Lindsay, 19. Tony Hughes, 31. Conorak Synthesymphone, 14. Matt Turner, 20. Jeremiah Weinberger, 23. Oliver Lacey, 23. Joseph Bredeholt, 25. Thank you for listening to this Crimes and History podcast. For suggestions or comments, please find us on Twitter @CrimesHistory.